This is the Stamfords Podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Further ado, it just being a whisker after 3 o'clock, we're looking forward to go to Sri Lanka now with an award-winning travel writer. Please welcome John Gimlett.
Thank you for that wonderful welcome. It's great to be here. Absolutely lovely. Now, let's get myself sorted out. Now, it's a very exciting thought for me to be addressing an audience that's so well-read and I suspect so well-travelled. Can I just have an idea of who's been to Sri Lanka already? Could you just give quite a lot of people. Does anybody want to, and there's a little prize for this, tell me what they think the population of Sri Lanka is. The nearest gets it. 20. 20, anybody else? 30? 3, no, it's been, no, yeah. 15, no. 20 gets it. That was you, wasn't it, 20? Would you like to come and collect that afterwards? All right. Collect it afterwards, don't worry about it. Okay, so one thing I can be confident about amongst us outsiders to Sri Lanka is that all of us are really searching for meaning. As one United Nations diplomat put it after his term there, he said, the longer you know Sri Lanka, the longer you've been there, the less you understand it. And I wish I'd known that back in 2009 when I first thought about this journey that I was going to undertake. Perhaps I should have done. Because at that stage, Sri Lanka had a luxury tourist industry up one end and a full-scale civil war up the other. And it had been a very odd war. At one point, peacekeepers appeared, only to be shot by both sides. On another occasion, back in 2006, 5,000 terrorists, or cadres, whatever you like to call them, simply changed sides, almost overnight. And then, in circumstances that no one truly understands, it ended. Asia's longest ever civil war. So what did it feel like, I wondered, after 26 years of fighting? Was it still the paradise that had been described by earlier writers? And how had it come to this? I interviewed dozens of people in London, read pallets of books, and by 2013, I was ready. And a lot of these people that I'd met were here in London, and they all said such different things about Sri Lanka that I began to wonder if there were several different Sri Lankas. And many of them asked for anonymity. What was that all about? Was that modesty or anxiety? And I remember one woman coming round and standing in our kitchen at our house, working herself into an inexplicable rage. In that case, about the causes of the war and language. And that's when I thought, what have I let myself in for? But nowadays, almost 1 million people a year go to Sri Lanka to be suntanned and bewildered. And that includes 120,000 Britons. Now, I'm not going to take you on their journey today to wonderful places like Kandy, Gaul, and Sigiriya. Instead, I'm going to take you to 4 places which are not often seen and which, to me, perfectly express the complexity of this beautiful land. And along the way, I want to introduce you to a few of the people that I met. But before doing so, it's worth just reminding ourselves what it is that we love about this country. I don't suppose I shall ever again see such consistently lovely landscapes. Exquisite, both in panorama and detail. Most of these pictures you're about to see I took myself, but this is a particular favourite of mine. It shows a man washing his elephant in the Kelanaya River as if it's the family saloon. It's an island that's almost completely rimmed in sandy beaches. There's only one natural harbour, and that's Trincomalee, and it's one of the best natural harbours in the world. Now, although Sri Lanka is only the size of Ireland, it rises to a height of 2,500 metres. And when weather systems coming across the Indian Ocean hit this mass of rock, they burst, creating a land that is both Africa dry and fabulously lush. And from these highlands come these sort of fantasy rivers pouring down amongst hills that are so green they seem almost to glow with their own internal light. Now, to humans, this island is covered in food, and to the animals that live there, it's really an enormous salad. And it's home to a startling array of creatures, including the greatest concentration of leopards in the world, not to mention the crocodiles and the kingfishers. And you'll have here the biggest creature that's ever roamed the planet, the blue whale, and now the biggest land creature, the elephants. Now, if we just stick with the analogy of Ireland for a moment, if you can imagine just one elephant wandering around the Republic of Ireland, it would cause absolute chaos. And yet Sri Lanka has nearly 7,500. And of those elephants, 75% of them don't live in national parks. They live in farms or in forestry, and they somehow merge in with the Sri Lankan population. It's an extraordinary feat of cohabitation, if you like. Now, it's not long before the curious ways of this country, the mysterious ways, start crowding in. And I don't just mean boys dressed up in beards. There's so much here for the outsider to misunderstand. Caste, astrology, the concept of losing face. Then there are two languages, two main languages, each with their own language, which to us really look like just sort of rather pretty seashells. Now, most of the time, it's enough just to sit back and enjoy it. The parades that well up from nowhere, the street cricket, the little monkeys on gall-faced green dressed as Europeans, the dancers in silver armour, and the elephants riding around in trucks. Now, foreign writers, as you can imagine, have been readily confused by this country. And this is one of my favourite quotes here by Leonard Woolf, the novelist, writing in 1904. "I'm partially drunk with the complete unreality of it all and a very little whiskey. I feel as if I were playing the buffoon in a vast comic opera." He wasn't the only one. Mark Twain called by, and he thought that Ceylon, as it then was Asia, taken to extremes. And then there were two men who called by, two world-famous novelists who called by, both of whom had rather strange sexual encounters in Sri Lanka. The first was Anton Chekhov, the Russian writer, on his way back from the penal colony in Siberia, and he ended up thinking of Sri Lanka as a sensual place, replete with opportunity. And then there was Pablo Neruda, the Chilean writer, who was here as a diplomat in the 1920s. And he thought Sri Lanka lovely and sly. But life can be complicated too. Sri Lanka has one of the highest suicide rates in the world, and yet it has nothing to do with misery. Sri Lankans are the most charitable people in the world, giving away almost more per head than anyone else. And then there's the age of purity. This is a country where, for a while, an innocuous film like The Da Vinci Code was banned, and public displays of affection are frowned on, and likewise the conspicuous consumption of meat or alcohol, bikinis and dogs. Now, I would spend 3 months over this journey trying to build up a picture through interviews and experiences. And I travel in any way I could, particularly in the remote areas. It might be by motorbike or by tuk-tuk, as you can see in this picture. Sometimes also by bus, or in this particular case, on this rather wonky-looking ferry. At one point, I crossed the Jaffna Lagoon with these local Japanese fishermen. And even for this seemingly harmless and innocuous journey, I had to get the permission of the regional naval commander, which gives you some idea of the complications of travelling in this particular part of the world. But best of all, of course, was the railway system. A perfect Victorian system still exists, and it still carries 88 million passengers a year. And it's all there, ladies' waiting rooms, clocks made in Ludgate Circus. Riding through the Highlands on one of these trains is like travelling along in a little Hornby train set. And during this journey, I stayed really wherever I could. Sometimes, as you can see here, in this old Portuguese fort built out on a reef out at sea. Another time, I stayed in a Benedictine monastery, and I even slept in a tree. And that takes a little explaining. What happens is that in the area where the elephants and the humans compete for food, the rice farmers use these tree houses called masa. And I teamed up with a farmer called Mahatun, and he said, yeah, you're very welcome to come and spend the night in my tree house. And the idea is what you do is you go up into your tree house and you sing. And it's the sound of singing that keeps the elephants off your rice, frightens them off. So Mahatun sang, and from way over in the distant trees came the sound of other farmers singing back to him. Well, then it was my turn, and in fact, I'm not very good at singing. I don't really know any songs, so I sung Yellow Submarine. It was obviously very successful because we didn't have any elephants that night at all. But you might like to think what you were singing if you were trying to keep the elephants off your lunch. Now, the first place that I want to take you to in this journey is actually close to home. It's here in London. And it's worth thinking that there is a little Sri Lanka here in London. There are 120,000 Sri Lankan Tamils in London alone. And in my area, I live very close to Tooting, there are 8,000 Sri Lankan Tamils. And it's worth thinking about that figure for a moment, because what that means is there are more Tamils in Tooting today than there were ever British in Ceylon at the height of the empire. And they live in a very introspective world. They need very little from the rest of London. They have their own clubs, their own charities, their own dance academies. They have their own yellow pages. And it gives a curious glimpse of London, coy, jewelled, and Asian. They even have their own internal crime wave with gangs like the Jaffna Boys and the Tamil Posse. And they goad each other with swords and knives, and London hardly seems to notice at all. There are 22 Sri Lankan Tamil temples in London. And this is my local one in Tooting, or at least it was. It's closed now. Most of the worshippers in this particular temple were all from a single town called Velvetitarai up in the north of the island, and they're almost exclusively refugees. They are a very traumatized community. They're very low caste, fishing caste. Most of them don't speak English at all, certainly not the adults. Of course, the children do because they go to school here. And there's very strong support here for the Tamil Tigers. That's the terrorist organization, otherwise known as the LTT. So strong, even, though they were easily able to provide me with an LTT flag, which they produced for me and gave it to me. Now, just a word about this flag. It is, strictly speaking, illegal to show this flag in public in this country. It's an organization as banned as ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So I'll quickly put it away, and you didn't see it, all right? Anyway, as far as the Sri Lankan media are concerned, Tooting is their sort of Mogadishu hotbed of insurgents and rebels. And for those of us who have to live around there, that's always a rather curious thought, as you can imagine. Now, my Tooting contacts would play a very important role in the journey ahead, because throughout the 3 months that I was in Sri Lanka, Sri Lankans were impeccable hosts, and I was always treated with extraordinary kindness and curiosity wherever I went. Whether I was amongst farmers, or former presidents on one occasion, test cricketers, or terrorists, only occasionally would that mask of serenity fall away, and people would regale me with their rage. It's very easy to forget what people in this country have been through. And that's particularly so up north, in the areas most deeply affected by the conflict, where people could be happily inscrutable. And outsiders often talk about that smile and the faces that give so little away. Often, it was only back in Tooting that I would hear about the harsh reality of life in Sri Lanka during those last 3 decades. Now, on a slightly lighter note, this picture is a man selling toddy. And toddy, as many of you will know, is a sort of fermented palm sap. And it's very cheap, it's about 25p a pint. And I have to say, I wouldn't recommend it. It's a bit like drinking, how can I put it really? It's a bit like drinking sort of slightly fermented washing up water, if you can imagine that. So, yeah, pretty disgusting. Now, the second place that I want to take you to is the Vedarata. And this is an area still inhabited by the original inhabitants of this island. There are Aboriginal people who've been hunting these forests for maybe 32,000 years. And they came long before the Tamils and the Sinhalese arrived there. And nowadays, there are only about 500 culturally distinct Veda left. And they're confined to a tiny area of forest just below the centre and slightly to the east. They're a very curious people. They have their own language, which is a sort of onomatopoeic language of the forest. So, for example, a motorbike is a hutu hutu. As far as the English language is concerned, they describe it as, the literal translation is, birds shouting, because that's how they think we sound. And traditionally, they had no use for names. They just call each other things like fat boy and oldie. They never farm, they hunt, and they forage, and they gather wild honey in the forest, like you can see these chaps are doing here. And historically, had a great reputation for ferocity. They were the devils of the forest. And whenever the Portuguese or the Dutch arrived, they could always be relied on to rain down arrows on their heads. But modern life has not favoured them. And in the Civil War, they lost all their guns, and now their king, for that's what he calls himself, spends his time petitioning the United Nations, or bottling honey, or entertaining visitors, like me. Now, the Veda, when I were there, put on, just for me, a little dancing display, and didn't really go according to plan, because for the first and only time when I was in Sri Lanka, I was suddenly taken rather ill as I was watching their show. And I had to rush off into the jungle and be sort of rather candidly sick. Now, the Veda had never really quite experienced this reaction to their dance before, and they didn't quite know what to do. So they just carried on dancing, really, leaving a slightly sort of surreal picture of them dancing away, doing their welcome dance, whilst their audience is being candidly sick in the forest nearby. Our friendship, on the other hand, did recover from that little setback. And my favourite of the hunters was this man you can see in the picture now. He's called Sudhu. And Sudu was very keen to make me one of the longbows that the tribe or this group of people use. And I explained to him that the Vedder longbow is too big. I couldn't have one. They're too big to go in our aeroplanes. And he said, well, you know, don't worry. And instead, he gave me a little charm to frighten off poisonous snakes. Now, on my last day, I was sitting outside my tent just near the Vedder village, and two poisonous snakes came up to the tent, and they got near, and then they sort of wriggled away. And I thought, well, that's good. Okay, that means that Sudu's charms are obviously working very well. And then Sudu himself appeared from the long grass, and he said, John, I've made you this, a little bow. It should be just the right size to go in one of your aeroplanes. So there you are, my Vedder proud souvenir. The third place that I want to take you to in this sort of lightning tour is Jaffna. Jaffna is the capital of the Tamil world. It's a sort of right in the top of the island, big city, only about 30, 40 miles from India, in fact. And it's a sort of mini Calcutta or Bombay light, a city of cupolas, gopurams, and bangalore roofs. This is the main street here called Parangituru or Foreigner Street, painted this amazing buttercup yellow. And there's a bazaar here that blazes all night. And it sometimes feels as though you can buy anything here as long as it's Indian. Now, the city has paid a very heavy price for its revolt during the Civil War and spent much of the 1990s under siege. And at one point, the Tamil Tigers ordered everybody out of the city, everybody out of that peninsula, that top part of Sri Lanka, and forced them through the isthmus into the main body of the island. 600,000 people were marched south. And this has left a very potent scar, as it were, on the psyche of the city. Everybody will tell you about that moment in their story, when the city literally became just a city of dogs. Jaffna, I'm happy to say, is recovering. It sometimes seems that one of the first things to recover is the ice cream parlours. You can always get a good ice cream in Jaffna. But many other features of the city are recovering too. This building in this picture is the headquarters of the old Norwegian monitoring mission. And what the Norwegians did during the Civil War, they were here to try and keep the warring factions apart. You can imagine what a thankless task that was. Anyway, this is their mission headquarters, which is now a very desirable boutique hotel. And other businesses are thriving too. One of my favourites is a funeral business called Eason's. And Eason's have their premises out in the sort of bomb sites there. So it's all rubble, and then there's Eason's funeral parlour. And at night, it has a little sort of neon sign that flashes. And all the flashing sign says is funerals, day or night service. Sometimes seems that the only thing that's really survived unscathed in Jaffna are the old British cars. Hillman's, Austin Cambridge's, Somerset's, and Morris Oxford's. During much of the Civil War, they were the only cars available. You could still see them around. You could even buy one, completely refurbished, for about £5,000. And you can still find a few of them that still run on cooking oil. Apparently, you need a little drop of thinners just to get the engine going. Now, a little way outside Jaffna, I came across this man, and I was told that he was very low caste, and his job is to wash the bodies of the dead. He's very poor indeed, and he told me that this is really his only possession in the world, an Austin A50. Now, for many years, people have not been able to get outside the city of Jaffna and onto the Jaffna archipelago, the islands that lie scattered outside the city. And there are dozens of them. And they once had great Dutch names like Haarlem, Rotterdam, The Hague, and so on. And the lagoons between them are only a few feet deep, so they're all linked by causeways, and you can very easily get driven or drive between them. And Sir Christopher Ondaatje once described them as the most beautiful islands in the world. And perhaps he's right about that. Anyway, of these islands, easily my favourite is Delft, the only one that's kept its Dutch name. It's about half the size of Manhattan. During the Portuguese period, it was known as the Ilha de Vacas, or the Isle of Cows. And you can still see all the sort of dry stone walls there. There's even a Portuguese fort left over. And this being an island of lots of mythology and stories, the locals will take you to a place where there's a giant's footprint in the limestone. Now, there's no restaurant or accommodation on the island, but you can get lunch with the lady who cooks for the local council. And the reason I want to show you this picture of her house is because of the door. And those of you who've been to Oman or Zanzibar will recognize that style, that Omani-Zanzibari style. And it gives you some idea of the influences that have been brought to bear in this particular part of the world. I want to digress just for a moment to talk about a very short period at around the time of the Napoleonic Civil War. Between 1811 and 1824, Delft was run by an Irishman called Edward Nolan, Lieutenant Edward Nolan. And he was supposed to be here growing flax for the Royal Navy. But being a good Irishman, he was pretty soon breeding horses. And his stock were the animals that had been left behind by the Portuguese. And I love the idea that these horses are one last genetic link with the conquistadors. And they're still there. There's about 100 of them. And they have something about them of the spirit of this archipelago, grand, disowned, and obstinately feral. Now, Nolan also ran Delft as his own private sultanate. And his stables are still there. There they are in that picture, together with his residents. Now, the local aristocracy got very jealous of Nolan, and they complained to the British authority. In a typical British fashion, we set up an inquiry. A panel of inquiry was sent up to Delft, and all the locals came to give evidence. And it was on the basis of their evidence that Lieutenant Nolan was gloriously acquitted. Edward Nolan was said to have had skin as white as milk, and to have made love to all the local girls, which is why, even today, they say, Delftians still smile with Irish eyes. Now, my fourth and last place that I want to take you to is back in Colombo, and it's a victory parade. It's a strange occasion, because nobody, apart from me, seemed to be watching. And I had a sense that Colombo had wearied of soldiers and victory. And here were Sri Lankans, as I'd never really seen them before, women slung with guns, special forces in those sort of leopard spot uniforms, and row after row of amputees wheeling past in their wheelchair. And then the top brass wearing their sort of Victorian best, as if the last 100 years hadn't really happened at all. Meanwhile, ordinary Sri Lankans have paid a heavy price for the last 26 years. 800,000 have been displaced. The war has cost billions. 27,000 servicemen have died. And as you travel around Sri Lanka, what you'll often see are these. These are bus shelters, which the families of a soldier who's died will take over the bus shelter, and they'll paint it in his army colours or navy colours, and there'll be a little portrait of the dead serviceman inside. I must say, I was always very touched by the democracy of these places and the idea of waiting and a journey ahead. Meanwhile, it seemed the soldiers too have wearied of war. And back at the victory parade, when the soldiers saw me, they very often call me over. And these guys hauled me up inside their armoured car. I don't think they'd ever seen anybody so white and unwarlike before. Anyway, we sat there inside their sort of tank thing, and we exchanged photographs of our children and our houses, and they talked about their farms and their fishing boats. And although we never had the language to finish these stories, I got the sense of what they were saying, and that like my journey, an era had ended, and it was time to go home. Now, since then, Sri Lanka has changed. The old regime, as you will have heard, has been ousted and replaced in part by these people, the UNP. Now, I won't trouble you with their politics, but what is rather pleasing about it is that their symbol is an elephant. Now, this is a UNP rally in Badulla, which is a tea-growing town up in the Highlands. And what puzzled me about this rally is that wherever the UNP marched, they left this trail of shoes. I mean, how could people be so careless with their footwear, just leaving these things everywhere? Oh, well, it's just part of the mystery of this magical land. Meanwhile, back in London, the struggle goes on. Tooting's Tamils continue to march, and they continue to squabble about what happened to the missing Tamil tiger millions. No new leader seems to have emerged, and there are even those in Tooting who argue that Prabhakaran, that's their leader who was killed on the battlefield, they still argue that he's still alive, despite all those pictures on the internet of him with most of his head missing. And they'll tell you in Tooting he escaped by ambulance, or he escaped dressed as a Muslim woman. And one man told me, we pray for him every day. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen, elephant complex. I'd always expected the reaction from Sri Lanka, the reaction to this book, to be more dismissive. What has a Brit got to say about this country? But they were intellectually and have been very curious, and the reviews from the Colombo Press have been extremely forgiving, not to say encouraging. And perhaps that's because Sri Lankans understand better than anyone else how complex life is in this beautiful land. And I hope you enjoy Sri Lanka too, and my take on Sri Lanka, if you're so inclined, in all its wonder and with all its oddities. As they say in Colombo, tikak pisu, it's all a bit crazy. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. We have got a little bit of time if anybody would like to ask questions. And if no one's really in the mood for questions, I'll read a little extract from the book in the few minutes that we've got. Does anybody want to ask any questions? Yes.
Many years ago, I was in Jaffna when the war was on, and the locals had a curry. Now, I can eat anything, but all my life, I've never had such a hot curry. And what the locals said, this is not what we normally eat, and we don't normally have foreigners here, and you're having exactly what we have. Do you find that the same thing with the hot curries?
Did I find the same thing having hot curries? To be honest, I didn't find Sri Lankan food particularly hot. I mean, I love hot food. So I didn't find Sri Lankan food particularly hot. What I did find is that it is some of the most gorgeous food in the world. I struggle to think... It's terrible to generalise, but I do struggle to think of where you find better food than in Sri Lanka. It's a lovely sort of fragrance about it. Sri Lankans are real foodies. They'll cross town for the right ice cream and for just the right kind of cooking. And they're very particular about the way things are done. Second only, perhaps, to the French, or perhaps even more than the French, in their sort of foodiness. So it's a fantastic country for those of you who like their food. Has anybody else got a question? Would you like an extract? And then I'll see if there's another question after that. The extract that I'm going to read is what happened when I went up to the battlefields at Mulai Tivu. And this is right up in the north of Sri Lanka, on a place called the Nantit Kadal Lagoon, where the war ended in May 2009. And on this particular site, which is called NFZ3, No Fire Zone 3, it's about the size of Central Park, and 150,000 civilians and 5,000 Tamil Tiger cadres were crammed into that area. The contention of the separatists is that they were pounded by artillery. The Sri Lankan government continues to deny that. Anyway, for 4 years, this particular part of the world was out of bounds. And then suddenly it was opened up, and with my army chaperone, I was allowed in. And this is what happened. It took a while for my eyes to adjust to the damage. That first morning began like any other on the northern gobs, lapwings on the shore and the buffaloes out in the silt. Sometimes fishermen, now tiny charcoal figures, would appear, way out amongst the sparkles, flickering along as if remembered in celluloid. I remember thinking how serene it all looked, or did I mean surreal? For a long time, the only other vehicle we saw was an old Morris van, made in Oxford almost a century earlier, and still tinkling along, dispensing ice creams. But then we turned round the northwest edge of the lagoon and back onto the long lip of sand. There were vehicles out here too, but they didn't have windows or wheels. We passed an ambulance out in the grass and a couple of Austins under the palms. From a distance, these looked like day trips. But as we drew near, I saw that everything had burst and that all the seats had melted. I began to notice cooking pots, too, and a long trail of rags and bottles and children's clothes. I now realized that we'd caught up with the great wheeled slum and that this was its wake, bleached and scattered 4 years on. Continuing down the lip as they had, we followed this trail of human jetsam all the way to NFZ3. Along the road, huge chunks of the landscape had been punched away. In places, the undergrowth seemed almost impenetrable, a dense thicket of acacia and spiny flax. But elsewhere, the sand looked bare and amputated and was merely a scattering of stumps. It was the palms that puzzled me most, either lithe and magnificent or sliced away at shoulder height. I remember tractor tires, too, ripped apart like crusts, and a small covil, or temple, decorated with bomb cases. Of the five villages that had once stood here on the spit, little remained, although there were still a few people living in the ruins. I even saw a tiny shop bravely trading amongst the wreckage. Then, just short of Vella Muluvaikal, we came across a long crimson scarp. This, however, was no natural form, but a vast embankment of metal. Packed within its flanks were thousands of vehicles and bicycles, all grossly distorted and blasted out of shape. There were buses that looked as if they'd been stamped into place, and then packed with tractors and scrunched up vans. Fire had burnt off most of the paint and rubber, leaving only rust and glass. Close up, it was like some evil cake, richly compacted with cars. They say that by the time the fighting was over, it was almost impossible to count the wrecks scattered over the battlefield. There were 10,000 motorbikes alone, together with 25,000 bicycles. Here, at this great red heap, the Vanni's great traffic jam had finally come to an end, and NFZ3 began. So there it is. Place difficult to forget. Anybody, any questions? Yes.
How easy is it now to travel up to Jaffna?
The answer is it's very easy now. Since I was there in the 3 years, the train has been reconnected. You can get the train all the way from Colombo. I'd strongly recommend people to use public transport in Sri Lanka. It's great fun. It's a great way of meeting the locals, particularly trains. Buses tend to be a bit dusty and noisy, but still great for meeting people. So, yeah, do go there. It is very easy. There were anecdotal tales that female travellers would tell me that things could be different for women travelling by themselves. But certainly for a man travelling by myself, no problem at all. People were very curious as to why I was there, very welcoming, very interested. So, it's a very positive experience. Does anybody else have any questions?
Can I ask, to be nosy, as you reread that, are you taken back to the places you so evocatively describe, or are you proofreading and copy editing as you go? Are you thinking, oh, yeah, actually, there's a moment I've missed?
Yeah, and I've never been to a battlefield before, and reading that or thinking about it does bring it back. It is one of the most traumatic places I've ever been to. There's one exception. I've been to Auschwitz, which, again, you don't forget very easily. But seeing these cooking pots and valuable wedding saris that people had cut up and to make them into sandbags and were still there over the place was profoundly affecting. And for weeks afterwards, I'd wake up and the first thing I'd think about was what I'd seen in that awful world. Now, I hasten to add that a lot of it will have been cleared up since then. Chinese contractors have been brought in to clear away the scrap and so on. So if you go there, and in order to understand the Sri Lankan Civil War, if you want to, then do go there. But if you go there, you might find that it's been cleared up quite a lot from 3 years ago. Is anybody else? We've got a few minutes if anybody... if you'd like another extract, a minute-long extract in the moment that remains. This is a very different mood, this extract, altogether. And it's about my return to Colombo. I was glad to be back in Colombo, breathing in its disobedience. It took me a day or so to get used to the chaos. Then suddenly I realized how much I'd missed it. Here were torrents of people again, all sweeping the rules aside. I'd forgotten how they drove as if they were the only ones out on the road, how they built whatever they like, and how they played cricket wherever they wanted, how the days got more and more frenetic till eventually the sun toppled into the sea, and how in the darkness everyone vanished, how the nights felt mischievous and close, and yet how, wherever there was neon, it was only a Diwala, or a statue of the helpless Saint Sebastian, pinned out like a moth. I'd forgotten, too, Colombo's incorrigible zest, even now, in the age of purity. Everyone here was either in business, in hoc, in flagrante, or in love. What other city spends so much time punishing its lovers with so little success? There was a hint of anarchy everywhere, even on the trains. People would fight tooth and nail to get aboard, but then, once on, they were all suddenly friends. That's my Colombo. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much.